This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 2nd of November 2014. The Monocle Weekly brought to you in association with Persol.
Hello and welcome to edition 278 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we hear about art and politics now as we ask author Anthony Downey, what is art's relation to the political and how's it changing?
Also, we hear about an Armenian-American writer's transformative journey to Turkey, and we change our view of London as we meet the men behind a series of new maps and infographics showing city life in a whole new light.
Plus, we look ahead to the coming week's news agenda with Monocle's very own Tom Edwards.
That is all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. You know, we normally say, how's your week, Andrew? How's your week, Rob? I think rather than going that, we'll just do the old, my dog's got no nose, how does it smell? Terrible joke, right?
Okay,
it's just quite a busy week.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Quite busy. And I think we've all kind of looked ahead between here and Christmas and seen it's going to remain so for the foreseeable future.
In my diary, rather than putting red lines on things which are important, I've put pink ones on because not only is that the only colour of the highlighter on my desk, but in order to make it a bit more friendly. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing worse than a red deadline. So we've got pink deadlines in my diary, Andrew. What colour have you gone for?
I've got lots of arrows, including one for after the show when I'm off to join Tyler in Stockholm.
Nice.
We're doing another kind of book talk and signing, which we're really looking forward to in Stockholm at the Museum of Modern Art. 300 people coming for breakfast.
Oh, the Moderna Museet. It's a great place.
Great.
It's a great museum. It's on a nice spot. And also the restaurant there. It's got a very good view
amazing.
So we're kind of
taking over the lobby, the foyer, at 8 o'clock in the morning. 300 people coming for a nice Knell Bulle.
Lovely,
Some coffee and some chat.
Nice one. Coffee, chat.
And buy a book.
buy a bloody book. Have you got a kind of Swedish thing to say? Like, taxi mycket, thank you very much. Have you got like a thing?
Oh, look at you.
Elskade, I love you. Oh. Stuff like that. You can put that in the front. Make some friends. You need me out there.
Did you have a Swedish girlfriend?
Yeah, I did. How can you tell? I know, exactly. I know two things.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I have
I know another thing, but we won't go into that.
Your Japanese abilities have improved.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, strange though.
That's exactly where I'll be going on a plane to. Well, Berlin. Bring the fiancé back. That's what's happening after this programme. But you can't do anything until this programme's finished. So without further ado, we're going to press fast forward and bring out the man himself, Mr. Tom Edwards, with his news look ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
I didn't know you could get your legs up so high.
Nothing like a bit of can-can, Andrew, on a Sunday to, you know, blow away the cobwebs.
It's all
that
fresh
clapping
now, is
at
it?
The end of that jingle sounds very like someone just stepping in a puddle.
Oh, thanks. That's the kind of reaction, that's the kind of frenzy that greets me almost wherever I go.
Woo! Yeah, nice.
Nice new jacket.
Trying to look the part, a bit brisk out, so, you know, thought I'd wrap up.
This is your kind of autumn into winter look.
It's
kind of like a nice charcoal grey. A bit cardi effect as well, cozy here as well.
Like a cuddly newsman.
A cuddly newsman.
That's what I'm trying to get. That's the effect I'm looking for.
Okay. What have you got for us?
Well, I wonder, as you came to the office this morning, I don't know which way you came, did you pass nearby Trafalgar Square or anywhere on sort of the number 11 bus
Annoyingly,
route?
Annoyingly, I didn't. No, I came on the number 30 bus route.
Ah, well, you wouldn't have seen then.
Nelson.
The historic. No, it's historic. The RT buses, the old one, not the Routemaster, one before that, 75 years old.
Whoa.
And they're working the route today, so there's not much time left. They're doing it until 5 o'clock this afternoon. So if anyone's tuning in and they're in London, there's still a chance to...
What's the 11 route?
To take
Is it just the 11?
Trafalgar Square, and then they sort of head all the way. I think they're coming from Liverpool Street.
Oh, that's right, because they do it with the Routemasters. That's the heritage show they do down Fleet Street, St Paul's.
They've got these even older ones. So this is like the precursor to the Routemaster, and it's to mark the 75th anniversary of these buses first running. And I didn't realise this. It's the year of the bus in London. So there's all kinds of bus related
activity. I thought there were a lot of them around.
Well, and these RT ones, in particular, have all been refurbished. But listen, so it's all free. So you can get a ride on a heritage bus.
Yep. okay, that's not worth all of those, surely.
Except they've got the very original RT1, the original prototype, and if you board that one this afternoon, you have to pay £5, but you get a commemorative ticket. But, you know,
wouldn't it be nice if
London?
The sorts of people that rode on those buses 75 years ago were still on it, rather than just loads of people with really, really loud earphones in, and basically buses are homes for the mad, aren't they? What is going on? What's happening on them?
But let's mix it up today. It's a heritage bus route.
Heritage.
Let's
nutters.
Get some heritage passengers on there as well. Yeah. But there's proper, you know, driver and conductor teams, and there's other kind of bus related brouhaha happening all during 2014.
It's the year of the bus.
It is the year of the bus.
Okay, cool.
To do something slightly more serious than that, I sense that that's where you want to go with this. I'd like to do a bit of election watch from Tuesday, US midterms, all the seats in the House of Representatives, 33 of the 100 seats in the Senate contested, lots of different state and territorial governorships up for grabs, some kind of interesting bellwethers, there's a really interesting Senate race in Florida that could have implications when we look 2 years hence. And I think, you know, there's probably not that much good news for Obama, likely, anywhere, frankly.
You're right.
No, not popular, poor man.
You don't like the US midterms, do you, Andrew?
Do you think on American kind of radio stations they talk about the local council elections in Britain?
Possibly not, but that's because we've got an international aspect here. True international aspect. Let's move on then. Let's do some cultural sojourn next.
We need a kind of a ringing bell sound for the bus there. Next stop.
Yeah, next. Off you go. Nice auction. Sotheby's New York, Tuesday and Wednesday, selling the Schlumberger collection. Mm. Are you familiar with this, Rob?
Yeah.
Modern contemporary masterworks belonging to the collectors and benefactors.
Don't you say Schlumberger?
Possibly. You're just making things up now, aren't you?
No, that's the correct.
I call it Schlumberger.
Maybe in America they call it Schlumbergers.
Well, I'm going for
I think
classic.
They're the Schlumberger.
Oh, Schlumberger. Pierre, okay. And I don't know how to pronounce his wife's name. incredible array. And they've got number 21.
Is that the bus?
One of the. This could be the theme.
Bloody hell, that's
no, it's
good.
Not the bus. Mark Rothko's, one of his canvases, red, brown, black, orange, as it's suffixed.
That'd be worth a few bob.
From 1951. Well, but you know, probably nine figures worth of extraordinary pieces.
That's 1, 2, 3.
It's a lot of zeros.
That's more than £40.
Okay, nice. It's like it's 75 years ago in Andrew's head still. We haven't moved on from the first story here.
I don't know what that is in
well, got wrapped up there. I've got my Rothko.
An Imperial.
Yeah, that's going to be an amazing.
It's going to be an absolute bonanza, but incredible work. So keep an eye, or get down and buy something if you've got that sort of readies. By the 5th of November, of course, here in London, you know, we keep talking about sort of weird English esoterica and events. It's sort of Guy Fawkes Night, and there's all sorts of stuff that goes on.
Too complicated to explain.
It's too complicated to explain, but there's one event. If people are in England, they could go to Devon, to Ottery St Mary.
Oh, well, I've been there for this. The barrel rolling, the barrel carrying.
The tar barrel ritual.
I've literally got some still terrifying pictures on my
extraordinary?
On my computer of going to this event.
Were you in the barrel?
I wasn't in the barrel. I was near enough from the barrel. They sort of run, it's sort of like a steeplechase they do with these barrels of burning tar on their backs, all the local lads.
Surely so dangerous.
It's exceptionally dangerous. It's great fun, and I think you're probably not allowed to do it unless you've had 20 pints as well. So you have to get really drunk and then get really strong, get really fearless, and then have a burning. And so these people, their hair's on fire. They've got, you know, they're basically all that. The only protection they have is a barber, tick, and a pair of sort of builder's gloves, you know, sort of hard wearing gardening gloves
need.
Or something. That's what they do, that's all they have. But we all know the great medicinal and protective qualities of having 20 pints. And that's, I think, how they do it.
Superhuman.
Yeah.
So we could do a kind of monocle version. You could have a glass of sherry, then run with a Hinoki candle on your back around the block.
Yeah. Have a flat white. An Irish flat white.
Well, that is in the diary for next year.
That's in the
next
diary.
Next time we roll around.
Yeah, and underwhelming reworkings of historical things.
Exactly.
Mm.
One final one, something a bit different, a bit out of left field. Like to, you know, surprise you now and again. On Friday, the Miss International Queen pageant for transgender and transsexuals is being held at Tiffany's Show Theatre in Pattaya in Thailand.
I was going to make a really bad joke, then. I'm not going to.
Don't.
No. Okay. Or it's also World Vasectomy Day that day. So there's all sorts of things to enjoy.
Oh, God. Well, how far we've come from the bus.
Well, I tried to bring in some, you know, political discourse. It was going to be gritty.
It was rich. It was varied. I loved it. I loved all of your stories.
And go and get the number 11. when the show ends.
Yeah, well,
we will do.
Sample its delights.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Pleasure as always.
How are artists today dealing with some of the world's most pressing political issues? What's the potential of art to engage with and even change the political sphere? And how can we even define the political?
Well, the new book, Art and Politics Now, raises such bold and vital questions, and many more, surveying over 200 contemporary artists along the way. It's written by author and academic Dr. Anthony Downey, who joins us in the studio now. Why did you decide this was the right time for this book?
I think there's two issues that alerted me to what I see as a change in the relationship between art and politics. And the first I would locate in historical event, the second in historical process. And I think both of these are located around the last decade or so. Effectively, when we talk about historical event, I think we could pinpoint September 11th as a moment in time where artists and indeed cultural commentators became more radicalized. And it's not even the event of September 11th itself, but the legacy of that event. War in Afghanistan, 2001, subsequent war in Iraq in 2003, the so-called war on terror, and the way in which the war on terror affected a delegitimization of certain rights. And those rights are around issues of citizenship, representation, and indeed the right to speak out against, for example, war. So I see a lot of artists locating in the last decade their practice in and around historical events such as September 11th and the subsequent war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then you have historical process. By historical process, I mean the ascendancy of globalization as the epitome of a late capitalist order, the way in which globalization has radically realigned the world in which we live. And you could look specifically at issues around migration, for example, labor, the environment, and again, how artists are directly relating their work to those issues. But you could also look at another historical process, and that is the absolute, it would appear, ascendancy of neoliberal ethos. And by neoliberal ethos, I mean the ascendancy of the market itself as the ethos under which social activity is now engaged with, and indeed the way in which society functions.
Well, let's talk about that. The market's an interesting thing. We can't talk about art without talking about the market for it. How commercial is much of the art in your book? I mean, there's one thing making political art. It's one thing if that politically motivated art costs £15 million at auction, isn't it?
I think that's an issue, but it's not specifically the issue. I think what has happened with contemporary art practice is that whilst there is still object-based practices, practices based in sculpture, installation, painting and film, the majority, if not all of the artists I look at here, are more involved in process-based activities. And by process-based activities, I mean art that is very much engaged with participatory practices, collaboration, or indeed the co-option of communities and individuals into the process of making art. So what we have here is a relatively non-commodified form of practice, which is not to say it cannot be commodified, of course it can, but it is art that positions itself in and around issues of engagement and dialogue with audiences, participants, and indeed the public.
Because the notion of what is political art, I was thinking about this earlier, is it would be quite hard to find a contemporary artist who didn't feel that their work was political in some senses. You know, if you think of Tracy Emin, she would be certainly keen to feel that she was engaged with issues about how women are perceived and feminism. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think of a really commercial artist like, you know, Andreas Gursky, he would certainly feel that he was talking about what's happened to global trade and commoditization of all sorts of elements. Even if you think of a street artist like Banksy, you know, he would feel that he was political. How difficult was it to decide, okay, this is a political artist and mm-hmm. this is not a political artist?
I mean, again, this was part of the problematic of the book itself. How do we disentangle the issue of politics itself? For me personally, I define the politics of contemporary art in relation to this book, at least, in and around issues of engagement. What I found when I was looking at these artists and interviewing these artists, that very few of them are interested, again, in end product as such. They're interested in that process of producing. What does that process of production do? Who does it engage? And if we ask the question, who does it engage, perhaps we get to the kernel of what is meant by contemporary politics. Contemporary politics today, I would suggest, is about determining what is and what is not political. Who has the right to speak? Where? When? And to whom? And increasingly, there seems to be a move towards the delegitimization of voices that engage with disagreement or dissensus in relation to a kind of consensual political model. A lot of the artists that I engage with here would seem to use their practice and do use their practice to open up different realms of engagement. So they're not saying they're for or against globalization, labor practices, migratory practices, the war on terror, the war in Iraq. What they are doing is opening that up as a site of debate. And it seems to me that that is in and of itself political. You mentioned a number of artists who are perhaps compromised by the fact that their work can be commodified within a market. I would argue that whilst these artists, and all artists in general, can be commodified, a lot of these artists are about working beyond the parameters of that particular system of commodification and focusing on how we open up the political as an agenda.
So give us a good example of somebody in the book who you feel kind of dodges at, you know, the bullet, as it were, if that's not the right phrase to use when discussing this, of commercialization.
The rubber bullet
of commercialization.
Well, we talked about the war in Iraq, and again, we have to be very specific here. I think in England, it polarized an entire generation of people, certainly polarized Great Britain and Europe. That was different in America, however. There was less polarization because there was less room for voices that were against the war itself. So you had an interesting emergence, I would argue, in the mid-2000s of artists engaging directly with the war in Iraq. Now, you could say or paint a picture saying, no war. That's not what I'm interested in. That's a direct political statement. What I was interested in was a number of artists, for example, Mark Wallinger in 2006. Mark Wallinger recreated a protest that had been outside the House of Commons for a decade. It was a protest produced by a man called Brian Haw. Brian Haw stayed night and day, 24/7, for a period of time outside of the Houses of Parliament until the Metropolitan Police removed everything, all of his protest placards and so forth. Wallinger rather presciently reconstructed from photographs that he had taken the entire protest and placed it in Tate Britain. The work itself was called State Britain. Now, what happened after Brian Haw was moved was that the British government, in its wisdom, imposed a 1 kilometre circumference around the Houses of Parliament banning protests such as the one carried out by Brian Haw. Some of your listeners might be familiar with the fact that Tate Britain is exactly 1 kilometre from the Houses of Parliament. So when Mark Wallinger reconstructed that piece, it wasn't like he was saying that he was for or against that protest. What he was doing was bringing that protest into an institution and re-engaging with the parameters of the debate, the political debate about that protest. So that's one way, I think, of re-engaging with the parameters of protest, but also putting it in an institution where you're least expecting to see it. Of course, an institution in and of itself can, to a certain extent, institutionalize protest. So you might want to look at other artists such as Jeremy Deller, who toured a bombed out car that was bombed in 2007 in Baghdad. He toured that across America with an American reserve soldier and an Iraqi asylum seeker, where they went to various places, public spaces, and invited people to discuss their reactions to this bombed out car. Now, again, this is not about taking a side, but what it is doing is opening up the terms of the debate. And again, I think that the key to this book is dealing with what precisely we mean by the political realm today and how do we re-engage that realm.
And you mentioned a couple of works there, which were actually the bombed out car and Wallinger's kind of State Britain, two things, sort of accidental works of art. They're made works of art by when an artist contextualizes them. But they're actually accidental works of art. How much does your book address this? Things that were protest banners, were the sort of ephemera of protest. I'm thinking also of the Disobedient Object show on at the moment at the V&A, which is an interesting thing of everything from the tapestries that were decorated, the miners' strike. So sort of, you know, riot shields and all the rest of it that have been graffitied. How much intention does there have to be behind political art for it to be an artwork in terms of there being accidental artworks?
I think quite a number of the artists here, it's not so much accidental. I think there's a rather serendipitous engagement with the symbolism of so-called protest art. So quite a bit of the book, especially the chapter on activism, looks at artists who use the symbolism of activism or protest art. But when you read it, works by Bob and Roberta Smith, for example, it's not making an overt political statement. Rather, it seems to be almost a parody of political intent. Now, I'm not saying that these artists are in any way depoliticized, but what I would suggest is that they engage with the very parameters of engagement itself. How do we re-politicize issues that are increasingly delegitimized as political issues in our time? How do we re-engage audiences who have been perhaps pampered by large-scale institutional shows, perhaps they're pampered by the media, How do artists interject into that moment? And I often think it is serendipitous, and perhaps accidental is a better word, whereby suddenly something else is opened, another way of looking is opened, and the question of who gets to speak when and where is re-engaged with. And again, I don't think anything could be more political than that.
And tell me, yeah, also in the book is Ai Weiwei, somebody who, despite the, I guess, the support for everything he does, you know, he's still a bit of a divisive figure. Not everybody kind of gets what he does or supports his way of doing things. Is that the ultimate, though, for political artists, that, you know, you pay with your liberty?
Ai Weiwei is an interesting example. He's perhaps the most overtly global political artist, and his stance against the Chinese state is interesting and, dare I say, brave. Is he compromised by then being imbricated within the market system? Perhaps. But I don't think, because there is a system such as the market that eventually co-opts artists into it, that that should disallow for artists to be able to engage with these issues. He himself uses a lot of different parameters within which to engage with that, often presenting something that is deeply political in a very apolitical manner. And I would direct your audience to his Sunflower Seeds piece for Tate in 2009, whereby he produced tons upon tons upon tons of sunflower seeds, which have been individually painted and individually produced by Chinese workers. Again, this ties into perhaps the specter of Chinese ascendancy, but it also ties into the notion of mass production. It also ties into the notion of individuality. And each of these in and of themselves are deeply political issues. That he himself should produce a work that is spectacular, manifestly so, is in and of itself, I think, part of the charm of the work itself.
And just finally, it'd be nice to talk about the idea of beauty, because it's such an unfashionable word to use in art criticism at the moment, and possibly precisely in political art. If something is beautiful, does it stop it from having its political teeth taken out?
Again, this is a difficult one. I mean, beauty.
It is a difficult one, isn't it? I just wonder whether beauty is the disguise under which politics can slide into the discourse.
I would say yes. I mean, when we were producing this book, one of the things that came back again and again was the images were not visual enough. I also was very purposefully choosing artists that work with images that are difficult. But beauty itself can be a political gesture, and I would direct perhaps your audience to artists such as Yinka Shanabari, who uses beauty or the aesthetic of ornament to make key political points around ethnicity, so-called race, and globalization. So it can be used as a Trojan horse to integrate something into a space, and it can indeed have an ulterior motivation to it as well. And that, perhaps to make beautiful work today, is the most political gesture, because it would seem to totally disavow any engagement with politics.
It was fascinating stuff. The book is Art and Politics Now. The author was Anthony Downey. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You are listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And we've been talking about art and politics. So here's a song about a man who was partial to the odd portrait of presidents. A leader or two, Mao, Nixon, you name it. This is Andy Warhol by David Bowie.
Like to take a cement fix, bigger standing cinema.
Andy Warhol loves a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
That was Andy Warhol from Hunky Dory by David Bowie.
Writer Melina Tumani grew up in America in a tight-knit Armenian community where diaspora life centered around commemorating the 1915 Armenian genocide by the Ottoman Turkish government, an event yet to be acknowledged by Turkey. Frustrated by the nature of her community's quest for genocide recognition, Melina headed to Istanbul, seeking not to demonize the Turks, but to understand them.
The resulting book, There Was and There Was Not, A Journey Through Hate and Possibility in Turkey, Armenia and Beyond, is an account of 4 years of conversations and reflections that unfolded. It's a book that raises questions as to how we use and abuse our personal histories. How do we acknowledge a tragedy without exploiting it? And how can we talk about genocide without furthering hatred? Well, Melina is on the line now from New York. Welcome to the programme, first of all. And it's a brave book to write. Was it an act of catharsis for you, first of all?
I would say it was definitely an act of catharsis for me, and a long, long process of catharsis at that, because it took me nearly a decade to work out what I really thought and felt about all of this.
And can you make it into an intellectual exercise when you have to write a book on it? Obviously, there are your own thoughts. There are thoughts you think you should have. There are the thoughts that you might want to hide under a bush. Then there are there's sort of making it possible for an editor to go through it and all the rest of it. Did you have to kind of go through lots of different edits to make it an objective rather than a subjective view? I suppose that is that's the kind of course that you go through with all the interviews and self-examination, isn't it?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I don't pretend in any way to be coming to this with an objective view. In fact, in the first couple of pages, I tell the reader that I'm an unreliable narrator, and I hate the way that feels. But
we like
no
an
way
unreliable narrator sometimes. they're better on the radio, for sure.
Well, for me, it was important to talk about that straight away, because all my life, and especially as I've gotten older and sort of become involved with a more sophisticated intellectual community of writers and editors and so on in New York, I would constantly find myself in these conversations about the genocide issue, and I would have to sort of control a certain inherent prejudice in my way of talking about Turks and Turkey, and to try to not seem like some kind of a crazy, irrational person when talking to another American, for example, about it. And that's deeply frustrating. And so with the book, I wanted to put that out there at the beginning. And part of why it took so long was because I thought I could make an intellectual argument. And in the end, it really was an emotional and a psychological argument that needed to be articulated, because I think the issue is fundamentally emotional and psychological at this point.
And tell us, you know, we hinted there that certainly Turkey doesn't even recognize in many senses that there ever was, they don't like the use of the term genocide for starters. And this is one of the things that lies at the kind of constant difficulties between Armenians and Turks, you know, for recognition, for finding any kind of mutual common ground where they can stand. So when you took the decision to go to Istanbul, to go and live there, what did your network of Armenian friends and family feel?
I think I can say accurately that not one Armenian in my life felt good about what I was setting out to do. And that even includes my parents, who were incredibly supportive. They were open and not harsh about what I was doing. They were worried, and other people were, generally speaking, I guess, looking at it as sort of an act of treason, a traitorous kind of a thing. At the very basic level, I think there was a sense of suspicion that I wasn't doing this in good faith. And that's been the hardest part for me, because if there's anything true about what I've done, is it's that I was trying to find a positive and constructive way to reframe this conversation. And so now, as the book nears publication next week, I am really hoping that the Armenian community in particular can understand that this was an act taken in absolute good faith.
Well, tell us about the Armenian community then, Melina. Tell us about where you grew up and what sort of dinner party conversation, what the playground conversation kind of was about this, sort of about this shadow that's kind of, it sounds like it's loomed over the community in which you grew up.
Yes, it definitely was a shadow, and not, I mean, a shadow almost makes it sound as if it were something unspoken. It was right there on the table, verbally articulated every possible opportunity. So
did it sort of bind you guys together when you were a kid? I mean, growing up, was it something that was kind of on the tip of everybody's tongue, or it was a leitmotif of the community in which you grew up?
Again, it wasn't even a leitmotif. It was simply the
heavy motif,
direct heavy motif of everything that we spoke about. And I talk in the book about the summers that I spent at an Armenian summer camp in Massachusetts, and how that was the greatest thing in my life throughout my childhood. And I spent the entire school year waiting to go back to camp, where we basically, in addition to doing all the normal camp activities like, you know, swimming and sports and, you know, crafts and so on, we also had debates about suicide bombing and whether it was a valid way to fight Turkey's denial. And we had Armenian classes, and we sang Armenian songs that were taken from the Armenian Revolutionary Armies who fought against the Ottomans. And it was an extremely, extremely powerful thing as a child to be handed that history and told you're a part of this important thing and you have a cause and a purpose. And it took a very long time before I was able to stand outside of that and say, there's something about the way we're talking about this that is not at all aligned with the rest of my values. And figuring out what that was, what the problem was, is really what this book was about for me.
Well, let's return to your journey to within the enemy camp, as it were. So you decided to go to Istanbul. Tell us why you decided to do that and what happened when you got on the ground.
Well, at a certain point in my work on the subject, I realized, this was about 2004, 2005, that Turkey itself and Turks as individuals were completely, totally unknown to me, even though Turkey had been this looming enemy other in my mind my entire life. I just suddenly became aware through a series of events that I describe in the book that I didn't know anything about Turkey. And I became friends with a Turkish sociologist based at Michigan, University of Michigan, Fatma Migegecek, and she invited me to travel with her in Turkey. And it was a very sort of sudden last minute thing. And suddenly I found myself there, and I was really overwhelmed by a sense of shock that this place exists. It has a variety of other problems. It's you know, the genocide is one small piece of the picture. And that stoked in me an appetite to really understand more about Turkey and Turkish society. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about the way that I was received as an Armenian. And that, unfortunately, generally is not good news. It took a very long time to feel that I had exhausted what I called my science project of talking to people about the Armenian issue, and realizing that I wasn't going to come home with a great diplomatic discovery that I had hoped I would find. And really, frankly, the news was worse than I had thought it would be.
Was this book sort of designed for any reader, a Turk or an Armenian, someone that went to the same summer camp as you did and sort of discussed suicide bombing when they were a kid, or whether it's a Turk who kind of thinks very little of this and brushes away the idea of genocide? Is there, maybe you want both of those imposters just the same to read it? Who's your ideal reader for this?
That's a difficult question, because I started the book with a very, very clear sense that I wanted to speak to the Armenian and Turkish communities, and I wanted to find a way to show them to one another and change the dynamics of the conversation by doing that in a particular way that I thought I could find some special language or something. This is a whole series of ideas that I now think of as delusions that I had about what I could do as a writer. And in the end, the book is really a lot more universal than that. It's extremely personal. It's extremely sort of memoiristic in the sense of trying to understand what it does to a person to grow up with this kind of concept of having an enemy belonging so strongly to a community. But then as soon as you start to feel little hints that conforming to that community comes at a cost, what do you do with that? And even to this day, as I get ready to publish the book, after spending all this time working out these questions, those same dynamics of worrying about offending my community still absolutely dominate my consciousness. So I think anybody who comes from a community like that, be it a religious community or a different immigrant community, even an activist community of some sort, I think everybody has to deal with that tension between belonging and individuation. And that's really what the book is about.
Now, in attempts to exactly understand the past and shade the past, there's been a huge battle over a single word, as we hinted earlier, and that is genocide. It's a very emotive and powerful word, and a word that is still fought over by both sides. What did you come to think about that term after being in Turkey, after this huge personal journey?
I don't like to talk about that too casually in conversation, because it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that I roll that question around throughout the entire book, and there are a lot of nuances that are hard to capture in one or two sentences. Really, it's not till the final pages of the book that I, you know, work out what I want to say about that. There's no question that what happened was a genocide, and there's no question that the sanity of all the people involved on both sides who feel any personal stake in the matter depends on naming reality what it is. You know, denial is incredibly toxic for people on a personal level, and it fans out to all different parts of a person's life and a society's life, and Turkey suffers from that deeply. And I grew to have incredible compassion for people in Turkish society who had that manifested in their daily affairs, because it's an extremely confusing way for a society to function. However, having said that, I do have a lot of concerns about governments legislating on terminology to apply to historical events, because at the same time that you have, you know, they might be right in one case, they're just as likely to be wrong in another case. And I think it's a lot more complicated than it sounds when you're a well-intentioned American liberal, let's say, and you hear that Washington is debating this genocide resolution, and you think, well, of course, they should pass that. One of the things I wanted to do with the book is show that it's actually a lot more complicated than that.
Well, it sounds like the answers are in the covers of the book, slightly within the last 10 minutes, but mostly between the covers of the book. That was Miline Tumani, author of There Was and There Was Not, A Journey Through Hate and Possibility in Turkey, Armenia and Beyond, which is out in the US on November the 4th. Thank you very much for joining us.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
What if you could take all the data you could find about London on everything from house prices to happiness, art to violent crime, and create a new guide to the city for the 21st century? Well, that's the idea that inspired James Cheshire and Oliver Uberti to produce their new book, London, the Information Capital.
Working together, James, a geographer, and Oliver, a designer, have produced a series of beautiful and informative new maps and infographics that show city life here in a whole new way. And they join us now in the studio. And we should say, before we introduce you guys, that it's not just a series of maps. It's a beautiful book called The Information Capital, which sits in front of us. Andrew and I have peppered it with post-it notes about our sort of favourite spreads in the book. But first of all, tell us how you guys met, what the genesis of the book was, what the sort of the idea behind it, and why it was London too.
Well, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was doing my PhD at UCL, and I was actually studying the distribution of people's surnames, so what the maps of names say about the people that have them.
And was this specifically in London or in the UK?
This was worldwide.
Okay.
So somehow National Geographic found me because they wanted to do a feature on North American names, and Oliver was the designer put on the project to help produce this really great typographic map of North American names that showed where the names were from and how many people had them. So we got to know each other through that. And then just on a visit to London for an award ceremony, Oliver swung by my office and we met for the first time. And I had this idea at the back of my mind about producing a book of new maps and graphics about London, because there's lots of books about old maps and graphics of London, but nothing about the contemporary city. So we needed a designer, and so I asked Oliver.
So Oliver, despite being from the US, you now have more knowledge about London than most Londoners.
Some people may be wondering why an American would be working on a book about London and the UK, and I was a little self-conscious about my citizenship when I started on the project, but as James can attest, in some ways it was an asset because I looked at everything with fresh eyes. As a reporter working at National Geographic, I always loved learning about new subjects and digging into them. And to me, London was just, you know, a joy to dig into all the data, the transport network, and the diversity of the city's cultures. And we've covered five main themes in the book, and every one of them was new and fascinating to me. So,
and don't worry, London's very generous with the title Londoner. You only have to be here a couple of weeks, and you're more than entitled to call yourself a Londoner. So, well, welcome to the club.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of those things, presumably, you've got your sort of an outsider coming in, but there must be something attractive about it as a graphic designer, presumably also. I think our producer, Alice, before you guys came into the studio, told us that, and I guess it's an unsurprising fact, that London is the most information-rich city in the world. Presumably that's a long history as a city, a history of immigration, a sort of quick expansion. There's been wars, there's been sort of plagues and great fires, presumably. It's something that wears its battle scars with pride, I suppose. It must have been, this is a question for both of you, I guess, something, you know, the greatest city to get your teeth into as far as bringing up information is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a tremendous amount of data now available thanks to government initiatives that have been pushing out government data. So London led the way in that. But also we have these long historic traditions in the UK about collecting data. We have the Ordnance Survey. We have the Office for National Statistics that collect one of the most detailed censuses in the world. So those kind of traditions combined with modern data dissemination and the computing power and researchers in the city working on it make it a great resource, and exactly why we called it the information capital, because we think at this moment it certainly is that.
Chapter 2 in the book is called Who We Are, and it devotes a lot of attention to the 2011 census, which is by far the most detailed census in the world. And for the first time in 2011, they asked, what passports do you hold? And we have
It's a good map. I love that one. Yeah.
Thanks. I worked on that one, and I worked on the one that comes spread before it about immigration. And, you know, as an outsider, I really wanted to make sure that I studied it. I read all the articles to do an accurate job, and was just amazed to learn that, you know, more than 3 million of the 8.2 million London people living in London actually come from outside the UK. You know, in terms of foreign passports, it's Poland number one. And then Ireland and India.
And James, we should pick out some of the maps. Me and Rob have our favourite, as he says, we've post-it noted them. I wanted to start with one at the beginning where you've done an overlay, because what's fascinating about this is the Booth map of 1889, Edward Booth, where he kind of literally walked every street or had people walk every street deciding whether a street was poor, building by building. And you've overlaid a recent map. And what kind of struck me about this was, actually, in many cases, nothing's changed at all, hasn't it? How strong and kind of fixed is the kind of the world of, you know, poverty and wealth in the city?
Yes, I mean, the contrast between rich and poor in London have always been spatial contrast in a way. The distributions of where people are and where the rich live, where the poor live, have remained unchanged for centuries. But what's interesting in particular about the Booth map and why we were keen to include it is because it, in a sense, it still sort of offers one of the most high resolution snapshots we've got of poverty in London, because he had people walk street by street, house by house to survey this information. And it's only more recently that we're able to almost go back to that stage, but through things like the census and fine scale analysis of other population trends. And it would be interesting to see, I mean, if we had to produce this book in 10 years' time, how those patterns persisted or whether they're starting to change, because, you know, house prices in London are extreme.
And there are some exceptions, you know, the remaking of the Docklands, for example, so you'd see strips of wealth suddenly coming down the river. But when you look at especially the south of the river, it seems completely unchanged where was up and where was down from, you know, the 1880s all the way through to today.
Yeah, there are those things that we sort of think of the artistic enclave of Peckham now as a sort of trendy neighbourhood, but it's still sort of poor, isn't it? I mean, the places like this, they sort of haven't, maybe the DNA of the people changes slightly, but maybe their bank balances doesn't, sort of relatively.
Anyway, Rob, I've got one of your favourites.
Yeah, I've got a spread here that you guys have done, which is called Greetings from London, and it's you say hello, I say... How do I say hello in Czech, Sheikh?
Yeah, well, we wrote it. We can't necessarily say it. I think that's
right. Yeah. Yeah, and we're sure going, thing. Oh, someone will write in and complain. But this is an amazing map, and it is a map of London, which people will recognise. The Thames snakes through it. Beautiful piece of work, and it's how to say hello in the most, presumably the most common language in that part of the city.
It's the second most common language.
Apart
from English,
Hello, so. And it's amazing. So people who live in South Kensington or have French friends will be unsurprised to learn that there's a lot of bonjour around Putney, Wandsworth, South Kensington sort of area. Salaam, which presumably is Bangladeshi, is around sort of east, and that extends down into sort of what is the Docklands area down there. And then we've got Mahaba, which I guess is Turkish, up around Dalston, all the rest of it. And there's a lot of Polish down in South London. If someone were to try to explain what an infographic was, this is the perfect representation of it, presumably. This is such a lovely, simple idea. When you get the information in your hands, do you have the idea of what the map will look like sort of immediately? You could have done flags with this, but this is such an immediate kind of... You get such a visceral response from this.
Well, this is a great one to talk about because it actually echoes back to that first project at National Geographic that James and I worked on, where it was the map of surnames. It was a typographic map, and I had made the entire United States out of the different surnames colored by ethnicity. And I think we were hoping to do something like that in this book, and James got this brilliant idea to cover languages by just using the word hello. So I just spent a lot of time knitting typographically all those little words together so they could fit into the boundaries of the different boroughs.
And what about, there's another one which is about running, where people run through London. I think it's got at night and generally where they run. How on earth do you know
how... it's just all around the main railway stations.
Well, no.
As in like, I've got 3 minutes.
No, this is running for fitness.
Oh, right. I've heard of that.
How do you get... Is that data from people who are doing... who have an app for running as well?
Yes, it's from... an app called Strava, which is a really great idea because it lets you have competitions with people and race them. So there's different legs along different streets where you can time yourself doing a run. And then if someone does it quicker, then you can rank yourself against those people without having ever met them. But it's a way of encouraging people to log their journeys and to log their fitness. And because everyone now has smartphones that have high resolution sort of GPS readings in, it's very easy to combine your GPS readings with the fitness data, heart rate, if you've got a heart rate monitor and so on. And millions of people now contribute this information online. So we were able to get in touch with Strava and
that's
they were
a great,
able to send
a great
us
idea
stuff.
That is.
Can I ask you a bigger question or what goes beyond the book? What seems fascinating to me is that, whether on our phones or however we come across them, maps are more used today than ever before. And here you've produced a series of wonderful maps on paper, in print. Do you think there's a kind of a renaissance, oddly, in the making of maps, not in the traditional sense of just kind of how do you get from my house to the pub and back again, but also in the way that you use data?
Well, there's a renaissance in graphics and infographics, I think, that's been driven by these new data sets that are coming online all the time. And so people are always seeking to better understand data, and visualizations are a great way of doing that. But also companies like Strava, who have a fitness app, they're always keen to communicate their data, and visualizations are a great way of doing that.
I think more people are also just kind of remembering that we learn through stories, and most of us are just very good at seeing things through images. And so if you can combine story and image together, people are going to retain that information more than if you just sort of speak at them.
Just before we go, because we've only got one more minute, but I wanted to talk about the mental maps here, which is the maps of how London black cabbies do the knowledge. And this is a fascinating thing, because I think Andrew and I both post-it noted this one. So maybe we can finish on this. How did you research this? Did you speak to drivers? Did you speak to the people that test the knowledge? Because this is a fascinating thing that I think anyone will want on their wall, because it's kind of, it's the shorthand that's in every cabbie's head.
Well, working in the U.S., I was communicating with James most of the time, through virtual chats. But I did have to come over and get my boots on the ground and to produce many of these maps, spend time walking around London. And when we were walking through Islington, we walked right past the Knowledge Point School. And I said, what's going on in there? And he explained to me, this is where...
It's a bit Orwellian, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's just all these motorbikes lined up and all the trainees are coming in there and they've got the maps on the... on the dash in front of their motorbike, and they drive around the city and to learn these routes. And I went in and I talked to the managing director there and interviewed some of the trainees and was just amazed that this map that you see in our book has got to be in the head of every one of them. I mean, and as the director said to me, he said, once Gabby's done it, you don't need a map anymore.
It's fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming in and talking us through your beautiful book. It's called London, the Information Capital. And you heard from the authors, James Cheshire and Oliver Uberti, authors, designers, map makers, all of them rolled into one. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that was me playing the trumpet there on that little outro. Quite good, isn't it? The last post. A bit of echo on.
Do you think they've got your jogging information on that map? I wonder if you kind of helped shape that map.
I'd like to quote our creative director, Richard Spence Powell, on that score and say, jog on, you mug. I just thought when you were talking about jogging, running, it meant sort of running to catch a train or to catch a bus or something.
I
know people do it, you know.
You need a kind of like a flaneur's map or a kind of like the sauntering map.
A flaneur's map. Maybe get a boulevardier's map. Yeah, it's good.
And I can have the sacheting map.
There's nothing wrong with the sachet, Andrew. You just got to... You should maybe wear your... I think this is quite a good way to wear your jumper, the way I'm wearing it today, to protect myself against the cold here at studio.
You've got your big kind of fisherman's jumper
knit.
On a kind of slightly French fashion. It'll be like kind of...
It is good, isn't it?
A bit scarfy.
Yeah, it's in honour of our sort of slightly themed December-January issue.
Yeah, we've got a French theme. Try saying that.
A French frame.
A French frame. Running through the book.
I know, it's going to be good. I can't wait for it to come out.
What, our magazine?
Yeah, because it means it's going to be Christmas. I loved today's show. I really enjoyed it. I think Alice Bloch, who produced the programme, put some great guests in. I particularly loved our map guys.
Yeah.
They were rocking.
They were very, very good. And fascinating, an American kind of ending up making one of the best books about London. There you go.
Also, interestingly, Bill Bryson has the quote in the front of the book, doesn't he? That says, it always kind of flabbergasts me that Londoners don't understand they live in the greatest city in the world. I could have told him that, Andrew Tuck. I said it's under nothing. Nice one. Should we thank everybody else? We thank all our guests, and we also should thank our crew behind the glass. Today's show was produced by Alex Bloch, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week, maybe with the same two people at the helm. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.